Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined as always by Frank Cogliano calling in from Charlottesville. How are things in Charlottesville?
Thanks to Charlottesville, our great David. It's graduation weekend is coming up at the University of Virginia, so town's going to be a bit busy this in the next few days, but the weather's beautiful, and yeah, everything's great. I'm looking forward, and in a few weeks I'll be home. I'm coming back to Edinburgh, and I'm looking forward to that too.
Well, today in Edinburgh it's beautiful, but whether it's beautiful in a few weeks, the summer weather here is capricious. So we will see, but for the time being, it's beautiful. Right. Topic we'd like to talk about today is a recent book published by David McCullough, the popular historian. It's a book called The Pioneers, the Heroic Story of the Settlers Who Brought the American Ideal West, which was published 8 days ago, and is quickly now on the bestseller list. It's currently the third highest ranking book on Amazon, and number one on the New York Times, or somewhere on the New York Times bestseller list, and has been doing quite well, at least in the retail market. But a book that's also generated a lot of criticism by historians, including a very critical review in the New York Times by Joyce Chaplin, and a very critical review in Slate by Rebecca Onion, and a number of other places. So Frank, I think before we sort of talk about the controversy over this book, we might want to do some, give our listeners some background into David McCullough. Where should we start with him?
David McCullough is a kind of presence in as a, he's a public presence in the U.S. and a cultural force, I suppose, in that he's very, very prominent. I mean, I think if we polled, 1,000 Americans and asked them, you know, not necessarily who their favorite historian was, but even name a historian, he would be pretty close to the top of the list for people in the general public, in part because he's widely published. He's published a number of books that won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes, in fact, for biography. He's published books that were widely read, widely sold, and he's also a presence because he's got a wonderful voice. So he's appeared in television a lot as well. Yes. And he's avuncular. You know, he seems to be he's 86 years old now, so he's not a young man. But he's been a presence in American life for a very, very long time. And frankly, I would say a kind of comforting presence. He's a bit like, and we won't probably talk about her today, but Doris Kearns Goodwin, in the sense that she's kind of public figure and a historian who people would know and many people like. And so when David McCullough publishes a book, it's an event. One of my sisters works selling books. And she said, when we get a David McCullough book, you know, it's always a big deal and they're always in the front of the store and that kind of thing. So, and he wrote a very well-regarded biography of Harry Truman. He wrote a very widely read, although I have some problems with it, biography of John Adams, which was the inspiration for the subsequent television miniseries. Well before that, his first book, which he wrote in the late 1960s, was on the Johnstown flood. He's from Western Pennsylvania, and that's actually quite a good book. I'm going to date myself now. His second book was called The Path Between the Seas, and it was about the construction of the Panama Canal, and that was the first kind of, to my mind, serious history book I read when I was about 10 or 11 or 12 years old.
Huh.
And I love that book. And in fact, when my dad died a couple of years ago and we were kind of dispersing and dispensing with his considerable library, that was one book I wanted. You know, the copy he had from, I don't know, 1977 or 78, whenever it was published, you know, first edition. It's not of any value. Millions of them were sold, but it was of sentimental value to me as the first, and I'm using kind of air quotes here, adult book I'd read. And I thought it was great. Now, again, I haven't read it since then, so I don't know what I would think of it now. But he's been around a while. He's an important kind of cultural force, I guess, in informing what people, at least in the United States, think of as history, and he's quite prominent. He is, it should be said, He's outside the academy. I don't think he has a PhD, and
No.
he's never worked in a university. He's never, he's not a history professor, and he's not a professionally trained historian. And I think at one time or another, he's actually sort of said, "Well, I'm not really a historian," but he's a kind of major cultural force. He lives, I believe, in Martha's Vineyard, in Massachusetts, and sort of famously writes in a shed. And I think this is probably overdone. I imagine the shed is probably pretty nice.
Shed's probably nicer than my flat.
Yeah, exactly. So he's a big deal. A David McCulloch book is an event, and this one, what interests me about the controversy, and we're going to get to it now, I guess, over the past week or so, is this book has engendered considerable criticism in places where he normally gets positive reviews. So, as you said, you referenced Joyce Chaplin's review in the New York Times the other day. There was a critical review in the Washington Post on, I think, on Sunday. There was a very the Rebecca Onion piece in Slate was very critical, and I sympathize with a lot of that. He's also got positive reviews. NPR had a very positive review, but there it has engendered criticism. I guess what interested us in thinking about a topic for this week is that certainly on Twitter, among historians, there's been a lot of criticism and quite a strong backlash against this book. And I think, on one hand, I sympathize with much of the criticism, which we'll get to in a minute, but I think you and I disagree slightly on this, in that I think the backlash is slightly overblown. And so maybe we want to get into that. So the so-called Twitter historians, as they call themselves, are very agitated about this book. I share their criticism. I don't necessarily share their anger about it, because David McCulloch's an old man. He writes books. That's the way it goes.
So, I mean, I think I just want to sort of pick up on some of the points you raised, Frank. So, what we want, he is not a professional historian. In fact, I think his undergraduate degree was in English
English.
literature.
Yeah, that's right.
And he worked for a while as a journalist. And, you know, he's his first book, the on the Johnstown Flood, is actually a pretty good book. But one of the things I think at that point, he was offered at that point to write another book on either the Chicago fire or the San Francisco earthquake as sort of a follow-up, and he turned those options down because he didn't want to be known as a historian who just writes about bad things happening to people. And if you look at his subsequent books, that is to say everything he's published since that first one, there's a sort of note of American triumphalism about his books. You know, the people he writes biographies of are people that he seems to admire, even if they're complicated figures. The people, you know, the events that he writes about, you know, whether that's the book about the Panama Canal or whether it's, you know, this the book he wrote a book about the Brooklyn Bridge, which I guess was maybe his second book.
That's right, it was the second book.
You know, and he wrote a book about the Wright brothers, you know, and there's a certain kind of overcoming adversity, American pluckiness aspect to his writing.
Very, very Ken Burns-like. Would you agree
Well,
to
in
that?
fact, I think he was the narrator, one of the narrators at least, for the Ken Burns Civil War documentary.
That's right.
And he worked for American Experience as a narrator for many years, and so there's a yeah that, he's in that vein. And I think Ken Burns's Brooklyn Bridge may have been based on McCullough's book, so there's a relationship there.
Right, and I agree with you. There's a sort of outlook there, a shared outlook. One thing I would say, the Adams biography, which garnered so much attention and praise, he was originally going to write a book about Jefferson and Adams, but he dropped Jefferson because he didn't like him. Which kind of tells you something. A kind of I'm offering that as evidence in support of the point you just made. He tends to write about subjects he likes and admires, if you will, and he certainly has sympathy for his subjects. I mean, it'll be very interesting. Maybe I'll go back and look at the Path Between the Seas again, which again I haven't looked at in 40 years, because I suspect it's probably less concerned with. It's probably more about the triumph of Theodore Roosevelt than it is about concern about American imperialism in Central America.
Oh, to be sure, right? Like, and you know, he's focusing on the Teddy Roosevelt's vision more so than the thousands of people who died in the construction, although he does talk about those people.
But they'll be heroic steam shovel operators, I'm sure, and things like that. But yeah.
Exactly. Right, so let's see if we can then sort of fit that into this recent book. For those of you who haven't read the book, and I have to admit, I've only read the first few chapters of it.
Yes, I was thinking about this morning, David, because as I was coming in, I thought, okay, we are exactly like undergraduates who are going to bluff our way through a tutorial about a book we haven't read.
Well, no, but here I'm going to be forthcoming and admit I've read about the first two or three chapters of a very long book, and he tends to write very long books. So my analysis here is based in small measure on that reading, but also mostly, in fact, on the reviews that I've read of the book.
I've read the criticism. I have not read the book, I have to confess.
Well, so for those people who haven't read the book, who are thinking about reading the book is about the settlement of Ohio, specifically of Marietta, Ohio, as part of the one of the territories settled as part of the Northwest Ordinance. It focuses on the sort of handful of people who found this community, their objectives in doing so. The book starts off with looking at there's a minister who is sort of the main character through most of the story, and his objectives in establishing this town. The narrative.
David, tell us the minister's name, because it's one of these great early American names.
Yeah. So the guy's name is, I'm going to butcher his pronunciation, Manasseh Cutler.
No, Manasseh Cutler. Manasseh Cutler.
Manasseh Cutler, yes.
Cutler.
Yes, I'm transposing the letters there. My fault. who's a New England minister. He's a Congregationalist. Who goes out there with a vision of creating, a new community and a utopia kind of thing out on the frontier. I just want to read the first sentence of the book, which is its own sort of paragraph, because I think it sort of sets the tone for the rest of it. Never before, as he knew, had any of his countrymen set off to accomplish anything like what he had agreed to undertake, a mission that, should he succeed, could change the course of history in innumerable ways and the long-lasting benefit of countless Americans.
David, I need to take a moment. I'm very moved by that.
especially with my really mediocre reading of the line, but imagine a really skilled audiobook reader reading that, and people just
imagine David McCulloch reading it.
Exactly. You're gonna be stand up and salute the flag or something. And I think that sort of speaks to the tone of this book, and I think it's sort of in line with some of the his other books. Shall we sort of go through the criticisms, and then we can see about what we think about them? I mean, the main criticism.
Well, sorry. I mean, in terms of just giving people a kind of clearer idea. So sure. The book's about the early settlement of Ohio and the Northwest Territory generally, the idealistic notions that the original settlers from the Ohio Company, as it was called, who were mainly, as you say, New Englanders. In fact, they're mainly from Massachusetts, who kind of had this stated vision that they were going to go out to the West and with a civilizing mission and also spreading democracy and settling Ohio. And this is about, if you will, the export of what McCulloch sees as the American ideal in the Northwest. Is that, and by implication in the rest of America, in the rest of the continent.
Yes, that's exactly what it's about.
Right. Okay. Now,
let's fit this into a historiographical tradition, if we will. I know you've taught classes on the history of the American West, in the end of the 18th, early part of the 19th century, this is considered the West. How does this fit into that tradition?
Well, it fits very much into the tradition. I mean, the first great historian of the American West, although then it was it was Frederick Jackson Turner. And Turner's frontier thesis, which he expostulated in 1893, basically said, democracy in America was a product of the settlement of the frontier. I mean, it's more complicated than that. It's actually not a whole lot more complicated than that.
Exactly.
Basically, as Turner argued, Europeans were transformed into Americans. They lost their sort of European pretensions in the hard work of settling the frontier, and that is what made America. His thesis rests on an implicit comparison with Western Europe, made America. The United States different from Europe and Americans different from Europeans because they overcame this environment, which included indigenous peoples, which Turner didn't really mention. But in the act of overcoming and settling the frontier and settling the West, immigrants were transformed into American citizens. And democracy in America and the egalitarianism of America is a product of the frontier. And essentially, you know, here we are 130 years on from that. McCulloch is making a very similar argument.
And in fact, that paragraph I read, you could have plunked that into Frederick Jackson Turner and, you know, it would have fit perfectly. So this is a very Turnerian kind of text. I think McCulloch knows that. I think he knows enough of his history to recognize how that fits, but I'm not sure he's fully aware that there's been 130 years of complicating Frederick Jackson Turner, that the scholarship on the West has developed an enormous amount, in large part in response to and in sometimes rejection of Turner's model, as influential as that has been.
Yeah, I mean, apart from the, massive and incredibly important historiography on race and slavery, arguably the most exciting field of American history and the most innovative field has been Western history, and I'm using Western to refer to geography. And that West starts in, with the Appalachian Mountains and more, it's much of the history of the United States. And so there's an incredibly exciting subfield there, which McCulloch might have availed himself of. It's certainly very, very interesting and innovative work.
And one of the things he does in this book is, he starts with, the Ohio Company. He starts with these, white settlers who are coming from, often mostly New England, to establish this town. If he had started with the people who were actually physically on the space before they arrived there, it would have been a very different kind of book. Even if you sort of look at the subtitle of McCulloch's book, the heroic story of settlers who brought the American ideal West. And again, that's a very sort of Turnerian kind of phrasing. So it's the absence of Native Americans, I think, that is really struck people as being the sort of profound flaw in this book, if we want to sort of put it in those terms, that McCulloch, by focusing to the Native Americans appear in this text, they're not completely absent, but when they do appear, they are perceived through the eyes of the white settlers. And he doesn't really complicate their description of the native people who live in Ohio, and who had a history in Ohio, dating back, thousands of years, but also a very recent history in Ohio of fighting against settlement before the people from the Ohio Company show up.
And successfully doing so, for a while, right.
When he sort of quotes the settlers, describing the native peoples as savages, there's opportunities there to turn that around and look at the experience from the native perspective, and he doesn't take those out. And so I think that the sort of the root of the criticism, whether it's the stuff that's appeared in Slate or in the New York Times or other places, is based upon that critique. The other critique I've seen, and this is sort of a less pointed one, is that the Ohio Company was very much a profit-driven enterprise, and that there was a, you know, corruption and fraud going on within the Ohio company that he doesn't really address in any meaningful way, although other historians have, you know, because he's very much trying to tell the story of these people with these values who are trying to make their way on the frontier, and the story of corporate malfeasance doesn't fit into that narrative.
Yet he takes them at their word that they're out there on a kind of, if you will, and this is problematic language, on a civilizing mission as opposed to out there to get themselves rich. Whereas, you know, in his subtitle about spreading the American ideal, well, there's nothing more American than sort of grabbing land in the name of high ideals to enrich yourself.
Exactly. No, that, yes. If the scholarship over the past 50 years have taught us anything, that's you know, the story of the West is the story of, you know, imperialistic capitalism, and that doesn't really show up in meaningful ways, at least in the few chapters of the book I read. So, what do you, sorry, go ahead, Frank.
No. I'm going to put a pointy question to you, we have set this up. So before we started recording, we were talking, you know, we were chatting as we do about how we might tackle this topic, and you described this as a racist text. Would you care
Oh,
to
sure.
kind of,
Defend that particular
yeah, defend
premise.
that assertion?
All right. So I think it's in as much as this text erases the native populations in and around Marietta, Ohio, and views them only through the lens of white settlers. It's presenting a vision of the American West, which is largely sort of depopulated, sort of empty and open for settlement, sort of a manifest destiny version of what the West looks like. One that, you know, it's a model that, you know, Frederick Jackson Turner would have been familiar with. And that the native peoples who are there are not seen as independent actors on their of their own right. They're not seen as people who have particular agency, or intellect, or political organization, or motivation, or humanity. You know, the story is told through the perspective of the white settlers for whom, at least in McCullough's retelling of it, is, you know, they view native peoples as an obstacle and potentially as a threat, but not really as fully human. And in you know, adopting this perspective, the book is sort of reinscribing the white settlers' own racial views, you know, onto the reader. It seems to justify, you know, settler imperialism. It seems to justify this kind of erasure of native people. Now, some of this is due to the sources he's using. He's using, you know, the diaries and letters and records of the people who are settling in Marietta, Ohio. But he's not taking the opportunity to read the sources against themselves, to read against the grain, to sort of think about other ways that you could approach the history of this region. And so when I say it's a racist book, in as much as it's, you know, in rearticulating the racism that enabled white settlers to go into the Ohio Valley and displace native peoples, in civilizing the region, to use their language. It sort of accepts that at face value, and I think that is, at its core, a racist message. Now, no, I don't want to ascribe racist intent to the author. I don't think that's what's going on. As far as I know, he seems to be a moderately progressive guy politically, and I don't think he was in his intention to send a very particular political message in this text.
Oh, sorry. Let me, if I can interrupt you there, and
Yes,
thanks
please,
for
Ben.
expanding upon that, and I kind of set you up, I realize. But I think in some of his writings, in his recent writings, and some of his essays and comments, one of the things McCulloch has said is he's been critical of President Trump, and but also critical of the, what many would see as the kind of historical illiteracy of many Americans, and he's trying to return, if it were, again, I'm not, as he sees it, he's trying to return to kind of explain first principles and a return to first principles in order to help Americans understand the situation they're in. So I think it is a political, I think it's intended as a political statement. I don't think it's necessarily for the reasons you just said. I don't think he's necessarily making the political statement he thinks he's making.
I mean, he strikes me as sort of a John Kennedy-ish liberal, with a small L. I think he very much sort of has a vision of America that is, rooted in the era in which he grew up, and is in some ways reinscribing that in his books. And so in some ways, if he's writing a text that he seems to be critical of the president, at the same time he's writing a kind of history that does seem to be a Make America Great Again kind of history in a weird sort of sense.
Well, I think his I mean he's much better educated, he's much
Well, to be sure,
smarter, but his
all these
worldview
things are
is
true. Yes.
his approach to American history and his understanding of American history, like President Trump's, is very much that of the mid-20th century, I think.
I think that's right. I
Yet
don't get the impression that he read much of any of the scholarship written on the history of Ohio and of the early West, written in the past 40 years. I get the impression that's not his method of writing. I think he sort of starts from, primary sources and goes from there without really engaging with how other historians have dealt with particular topics. And I think that's part of what leads him to, replicate a certain methodology that he cultivated in these, books that he wrote a generation or two ago, whether that's, the book about the Brooklyn Bridge or John Adams or what have you. But people who read this book, and I'm imagining the target demographic for this book, like most of his books, are white, predominantly middle class, oftentimes men of a certain age. They're going to have, when they read this or when they read some of his other texts, they read them to affirm what they already think about the past.
No. Let me stop you right there. I think that's an
Okay.
incredibly arrogant thing to say. And one of the
Okay,
things that's
good.
annoyed me in the past week as this has unfolded is the incredible sanctimony of so-called Twitter storians about this.
Okay.
I think this book is not very good based on what I've read, and there's no way I'm going to invest the time in reading it. And I think it's deeply flawed for all the reasons we've said. But
Yeah.
you don't know why the people who are reading this book are going to read that book. You're making an assumption about them and what they believe. You don't know that. How can you know that?
I know enough of the kinds of people who read his
No,
books.
oh, the kinds of people, David. That's exactly like when somebody says these people. You
No,
don't
it's
know. No, David.
not.
You
These
don't. You
are
can't
my
know.
relatives, and these are people that I care about who read his books and appreciate his books, but they read them for different reasons than what we read things for.
I think that, again, incredibly arrogant. I think, look, this is going to be a bestseller, and I think that's problematic, and we can talk about the consequences of that or why this matters. But because it's a bestseller, that means a lot of people are going to read it, and you can't generalize about the hundred thousands or the tens of thousands of people who are going to read this book. I don't believe. I think some of them will read it for the reasons you're saying, but I
What are the
but.
other motivations for reading it?
They'll read it because it's a new David McCulloch book and they don't know anything about the settlement of Ohio. And
Yeah.
that's, if you want to make the case that it's a dangerous book, I think the kind of historians running around with their hair on fire about this are overreacting a little bit. I don't think we should care that much, but I don't think you know why they're reading it. I think that's an incredibly arrogant thing to say, if I may say with all due respect.
Oh. Well, I
I
mean,
offer that with love, David. I'm just
I accept it with love. I obviously don't know what goes into the minds of every person who reads anything. I'm not even sure what's going on in my own head half the time. But for someone who is, I think one of the reasons why he's been very successful as a writer is partially because he writes well, he tells narrative history very well. That undoubtedly is the main reason why he's been successful. But I think one of the other factors that has contributed to his success over the past, 40 years, 50 years, has been that he tells a kind of history that people find affirming, one that find they find patriotic on some level, and I think clearly there's a huge market for that kind of history.
I mean, yeah, it's a comforting narrative. And again, I think Ken Burns is the appropriate comparison here in that it's even when Burns deals with problematic aspects of American history like Vietnam, it's always a
That's right.
tragedy, an unintended tragedy, not malfeasance necessarily. So and I agree with you. I think McCulloch is offering a comforting narrative, about American history, and it's all going to be okay in the end. And we're basically, as citizens, we're well-meaning and we're motivated by idealism and so on. And so that does appeal to people. It's very interesting to see how. I mean, I'm not going to undertake this because I don't care. But it would be moderately interesting then to see how his books are received outside of the United States by reviewers. If you went back and looked at how they've been reviewed, and or even if they've been reviewed. I mean, again, I'm not going to undertake this, but so it's. I agree with you that he's providing a very comforting narrative. I guess my slight overreaction there, and I do apologize, is
No,
that
that's fine.
I think we don't know why people are reading. Some people are just going to read it because it's the next David McCulloch book, and they might
And I
get
think a
something
lot of these
different
books are
from
going
it.
to be bought and not and may not be not even be read.
I think that's probably true as well.
I think
Father's Day is
this is a
coming up.
Father's Day present kind of book.
That's exactly what it is. And they'll be moving pallets of them in Costco and Walmart and everywhere else. And I think, and again, with respect to our colleagues who've been pretty agitated about this, I share their criticism of it. I'm not quite sure that I share the kind of concern about it in the sense that so people are going to read this book. They may or may not learn something about Ohio. They may or may not have their biases confirmed. They might read the reviews that say, hey, where are the Native Americans? And that might get them interested in that particular topic. It might lead them to the better scholarship, and God knows there's a lot of good scholarship on the settlement of Ohio. And that's a good thing. It's I'm not sure that this book, bestseller that it is and bestseller that it will be, deserves the kind of a deserve Let me choose my words carefully. I think the criticism of the book is warranted as a book. I think the interpretation is deeply flawed. I want to make that clear. But I'm not sure the kind of antipathy for McCulloch and what he seems to stand for is worth the effort, because he's not going anywhere. And his book's going to be a bestseller no matter how much historians complain about it on Twitter and point out its flaws. And it's a bit like complaining about the weather. There's another
Well,
McCulloch book that's going to be a bestseller. Okay.
there's some differences, though. I mean, I think first, I think there's some, fundamental principles that good historical writing has to uphold. It has to be based in evidence. It has to be true to the extent that we can understand the truth, which is a, philosophical question as much as it is a historical one. And it needs to draw upon and recognize the best thinking that's come before it. A historian who doesn't read what other historians write is fundamentally not, I think, doing their job, whether they're writing public, popular history or whether they're writing academic history. I think knowing what other historians are thinking about a particular topic is part of the mission.
Sure.
And I think in that respect, this book is a failure, because he doesn't seem to have read that stuff.
I agree.
And thinking about it like the weather, this book is, I think that it is displacing other things. Both in terms of what's on shelves in bookstores, it's displacing things in terms of what people actually read. And if someone is going to read a history book this year, I'd prefer them read something else. One that, is better history, in terms of not only the research that went into it, its understanding of the past. So I think I think the objections to it are on point in that regard. Because I think we should actively dissuade people from reading this book. If they're only going to read one book, they should read something else. The other point, and I think this is the more critical point, is for people who do read it, it is a. A racially, insensitive book, and if you, again, sort of linking this to sort of the Trump's America vision of what the United States is, this book in a weird way seems to confirm that, and that's, I think, something that is problematic both in terms of its understanding of the past and in the way it shapes the present.
Yeah, I agree with you about that. There's a kind of paradox here, because I think McCulloch sees it, and I don't want to go too far with this, as a kind of antidote to Trump and Trumpism. Yet inadvertently, he's written a very Trumpist book.
I think,
But even if that was not his intent, although it might tell us about the kind of range of historical thinking among basically some people of that generation when it comes to appreciating the past. In this, Trump and McCulloch are not all that different, frankly, which is the point I made earlier. But I mean, what I'm going to find interesting is I've got several transatlantic trips over the in coming in the next few months, and I guarantee you I'm going to encounter people reading this book.
It's a
And
book people read in airports.
yeah, well, that's what I mean. And if I do and I get the chance to chat with them, I will ask them what they think of it. But I again, I don't disagree with any of the criticism you've made and you've very articulately laid out. I don't disagree with the concerns expressed by our fellow historians. Well, I don't disagree with the criticisms expressed by our fellow historians. I'm just not sure it's worth our the kind of emotional investment and the agitation that it's engendered. Because, okay, it's a bad book of popular history.
Well,
You know, it's better than Bill O'Reilly's books of history, and now I am using air quotes. And so
but
people, you know,
you,
it's
if you got very riled up, if I recall correctly, about a book on Jefferson's stance on the Barbary Wars, because that was a
Yeah,
good book.
but that
Yes, that was a terrible book, and you got riled up, and you wrote a book in, in response to it. Now, I imagine for people who work, have spent their lives researching the settlement of Ohio and its early history, early white history at least, and are trying to be sensitive to the complexity of that history, and then have this thing come in sort of and swamp them with a narrative that ignores everything that they've done and everything that the people they've built from have done. I don't know.
Yeah, but
That's
like, no, sorry. I mean, we need to wrap up. I know, but let me put that to you another way, though. Now people will have heard of what they work on. So previously, those historians working on the Old Northwest, as it is
Yes.
sometimes called, you know, were in a subfield doing important work. The quality of the work, I know it, but let's face it, most people outside the academy won't know it. Now,
That's
when they
true.
say, "This is what I work on," people will have heard of it, and then they can say, "And this." So, you know, that book, you know, the Brian Kilmeade's terrible book about the Barbary Wars has acted as an entree for me at talks I've given all over the place because it's such a bad book. But people read it, people heard of it, and then that's, you know, it's a gateway drug to the truth.
Let's hope lots of people follow that trail.
So I'm not saying this is a good thing, but I'm also saying it's not worth our colleagues on Twitter being so upset about. I guess
Well,
I mean,
Twitter is an outrage machine. That's what it's for.
it is, and I find
So
some
you got to grade on a curve.
Twitter historians are incredibly sanctimonious.
That says something coming from you.
Well played, well played. That's
We are all sanctimonious about our own things.
fair enough. Fair enough. That's an excellent point.
All right. So on that note, do you have a last drop, Frank?
I do, and unfortunately, I'm going to change tone considerably. I want to bid farewell to a colleague of ours. One of our colleagues, Professor John Peterson, from the School of Social and Political Studies at Edinburgh, tragically and unexpectedly died over the weekend. And John, I knew him, I think, better than you did.
Yeah, no, I only met him a couple of times, but he seemed like a very talented scholar and a very kind man. But
And a very good guy, and John worked on kinds of transatlantic political relations. He was an expert on the EU, but he was American. He's from Vermont, in fact, but was interested in transatlantic relations generally. So he and I collaborated on several seminars. We did events together around the 2012 and 2016 elections, and I knew him reasonably well. I mean, I wasn't as close to him as our colleagues in politics were, but it's a huge loss, obviously, to his family, whom I know, and to the university. And I just want to kind of acknowledge, that I will miss John and acknowledge his passing. So it's a very melancholy last drop from me this week, unfortunately. But what about you, David?
So I have been trying to read up in the past 48 hours or so in response in some ways to the situation in Alabama and in other states about the history of abortion both in the United States and internationally. And one resource I found very useful is the Nursing Cleo blog. Are you familiar with this, Frank?
Yes, but tell
Yeah,
us.
so there's it's a group blog with a number of people who have contributed to it, including Cassia Roth, who was last year in fact a postdoc here in Edinburgh, but is now at the University of Georgia, but also lots of other friends of our podcast, Jackie Antonovich, Lauren Thompson, Sarah Hanley Cousins, and other people who have written for this blog, and they've got a really great coverage, a number of articles on the history of abortion in the United States and around the world. And I thought that was very If somebody's looking for a place to try to sort of contextualize this movement that we're having, moment we're having right now in the United States, in a number of states where they are restricting access to abortion, in some cases in a very profound level, this the Nursing Cleo blog is really useful for helping get some perspective on that and what that means, not only today, but what it means in a historical context.
Right. Excellent.
And we will undoubtedly sort of talk more about that on future episodes.
Yeah, alas, I think we will need to. But
Yes. All right. Until next
excellent.
week, Frank.
Enjoy the
Cheers.
sunshine, David.
Thanks.
Okay,
Bye.
cheers, bye.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is Professor of American History and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.